are listening to the Night and Day podcast, featuring the interview archives of Western New York music writer Tom Jennings. Tom has interviewed some of the biggest names in music and entertainment, and now you can enjoy these never-before-heard interviews. Here's your host, Tom Jennings.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Night and Day. This week we're going to start what will likely wind up being a three-parter with various members of Foreigner. I've interviewed over the years Lou Gramm multiple times. We'll make that a singular episode. I had the opportunity to interview Mick Jones, which was really cool because Mick doesn't do a whole lot of interviews. I've interviewed Kelly Hansen, the current lead singer of Foreigner. Kelly, great interview, you know, good guy. I mean, he a lot of people, of course, especially where I come from, are dedicated to Lou Gramm because Lou's a Rochester guy, and I grew up in Rochester, New York, where Lou's from. But Kelly, nonetheless, does a great job with Foreigner. I don't think it really takes away from anything that Lou's done, but obviously Lou is Lou, Kelly's Kelly. And finally, a gentleman whose interviews I'll have to dig out as well, as his name's Tom Gimbel. Tom is actually the longest running member of Foreigner aside from Mick Jones. The group has, you know, like any classic rock band from that era, has kind of switched members time and time and somehow managed to, you know, survive and continue doing shows under a particular moniker. Anyhow, this first one, of course, so we'll put up with Mick. Mick was the guy that put Foreigner together. He's the one that discovered Lou Gramm, and between the two of them, they produced some amazing music. I think that there's certainly a solid argument that Foreigner, the original Foreigner lineup, or, you know, at least Mick and Lou, should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But, you know, Rock Hall is, it is what it is. It's a little bit kind of quirky, and people don't necessarily understand why some artists get in and some artists don't. But like anything in life, I guess you just have to accept it for what it is. But this first interview, as I said, with Mick Jones, it was recorded in a parking lot in Buffalo. And we spent a lot of time talking about some different things. The topic that I think I enjoyed talking with him the most about was Buddy Holly. I'm a huge Buddy Holly fan. Buddy died before I was born, but man, his music is just, for as short of a period of time as Buddy was around, he did an awful lot. So, but anyhow, you don't want to hear me talk. Let's get right to the interview. Right now, an interview with Foreigner founding member, former Spooky Tooth member, Mick Jones.
Hello.
Hello, is this Mick?
Yes.
Hey, Mick. Tom. This is Tom. Yeah, what an honor. I must say, I know you don't do a lot of interviews, and this really means a lot to me. I've been listening to music for many years.
Oh, thank you. That's cool.
First question, I guess I'd like to go way, way back, because, you know, a lot of people talk to you about Foreigner and all those types of things, but I kind of want to go back to maybe that first point when you realized that you were going to be a professional musician.
Well, I guess when I started fooling around on the guitar, I was about 11, I guess, 11 or 12. My father actually had bought me a ukulele that he played. And, you know, he taught me three or four chords. And immediately I was kind of hooked. And I guess that's where the flame started, you know. And from then on, it was just a question of how I could be somehow involved in music. You know, I mean, I was a little kid, and I'd heard people like Buddy Holly, you know, there was a singer called Gene Vincent, and these guys had a huge effect on me. And I felt, I don't know, I grew up in a musical, sort of a musical household. My father played piano, and my mother sang a bit from parties, and but I think I saw a show from London called Sunday Night at the London Palladium, and it was the guest that evening was Buddy Holly, I remember he walked on stage, and this goofy-looking guy with horn-rimmed glasses and playing a Fender Strat, and just something about it. It just, I think in that moment, I knew that I really wanted to be part of that, you know, and play music, and eventually go as far as I could go. I didn't know what the future had in store for me, but it was from about that age, about 11, when everything started to sort of ruminate in my mind.
Wow, I mean, and that's incredible that you had an opportunity to see Buddy Holly, and Buddy also a great songwriter. I mean, was maybe if you could remember the first song you wrote, was that kind of a Buddy Holly influenced song, or do you even remember the song?
I did write a few. They were influenced. I mean, that's just my early fooling around stuff, you know. And I learned to play all the Buddy Holly songs on guitar. So that was my foundation, as it were, you know. And Buddy was, he was a great songwriter for the time. And the simplicity of his songs and just what he was representing to me was just this world that seems to me so glamorous and exciting. And at that age, you know, it sort of had a big impression on me, left a big impression on me, and that's what got me on the road to writing, eventually writing myself.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
No. I can vaguely remember it, but I don't think I ever finished it or got a title for it even. But, you know, I just fooled around and, you know, just try and look after the chords my father taught me, that sort of opened up the door, you know. And then I got my first guitar, which was like a Spanish guitar. And I realized that wasn't the instrument I was going to be playing. I headed pretty much after that straight to the electric guitar. And, you know, I suppose I realized with Buddy Holly that, you know, it was very, very simple sound he had, but it was brand new, you know. Nobody'd ever brought that sound out before, you know, on a Fender Strat. And but he was sort of a rhythm lead player, you know, a little of both. And I think that's probably what the most important thing I learned from him.
Yeah, and I mean, many of your compositions, I mean, they do have that kind of that really powerful rhythm piece. I guess now as I think of a song like, you know, Hot Blooded, it's not a song that's really heavy on the solo, but the riff is really intense. That's what grabs you.
Yeah, that's more of where I ended up, you know. I mean, I was intent more on As I progressed, you know, more intent on writing and the formation of songs and the arrangements and all that kind of thing, you know. I wasn't like a flashy lead guitar player particularly, but yeah, I mean, in the same way, I guess, as Keith Richard and Pete Townshend, you know, they're not. To me, it's always been their riffs or their, you know, the way they construct songs, and that's kind of the, I don't like to categorize it, but that would be the area that I I'm probably strongest in.
And I mean, you've written just a gazillion hits over the years. I mean, your catalog's mm-hmm. heard everywhere. I mean, what are some of the songs that maybe you're proudest of that weren't necessarily big radio hits, or maybe even surprised you that they never became super popular?
Well, there's a bunch of them. What I set out to do was really to write albums, you know, as opposed to like three big songs and then the rest just ignored. I feel that we made albums you could really listen to from top to bottom. And in fact, there is one that was very heavily influenced by Buddy, called Luann on the Four album. And there it's pretty much full on Buddy Holly.
Yeah, and I mean, I said you had with Foreigner, you also had some changes at lead singer. I mean, there were three guys. I know the two that most people talk about are certainly Kelly and Lou. But when Lou was first replaced, you know, and you did Unusual Heat, did that mm-hmm. potentially influence your decision later on when you decided to reform the band with another singer like Kelly?
Yeah, you know, I had really kind of, Lou and I had done this sort of a gig in Europe called The Night of the Proms, where, you know, there were three or four headline acts and with an orchestra and choir and all that kind of stuff. And at the end of that, we had tried to write during that time. We had quite a bit of time off, and it seemed like, you know, we'd sort of, in a way, we had been able to surmount a lot of other problems over the years, but it got to the point where I think we, you know, Lou wanted to do his thing, and you know, his solo stuff was in many areas sounding a lot like Foreigner. And at one point, you know, I remember I got a call from Jason Bonham when I was on this sort of rest time for me. And he made a big case to me for putting Foreigner back together again. He was really enthusiastic. And so we got together and jammed and introduced... a friend of his, Jeff Pilson, and who he'd worked with in a movie, I think, together with the they'd work together anyway. And before I knew it, I had a band. A couple of the guys from the previous band, and three new guys, and. You know, I didn't quite, until I found Kelly, I wasn't quite sure if I was going to go ahead with that. But when I first heard Kelly's voice, I knew pretty much immediately that he could do it. You know, he could capture the intensity of the vocals in the band, that he could represent the band, you know, really, really cover all the bases. And it really came to pass. You know, he really did. He's a tremendously hard-working guy, very conscientious, and very respectful of what he was, had been made part of. And he's just been an incredibly strong guy to have in the band and to, you know, kind of propel the band back into areas, you know, that have been missing for quite a long time. And yeah, so that was kind of what happened there.
So was it, you know, I mean, and not to sound, you know, kind of corny or everything, but, you know, the song Feels Like the First Time. I mean, do you remember that first show with Kelly? I mean, I feel like I've seen Foreigner with Lou and with Cab seen Kelly a number of times, and he's just such an amazing performer. What was your impression like as that maybe those first live shows? Was there any anticipation about how he'd be accepted or any of those kind of butterflies when you first went out?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, I expected some resistance at some point because, you know, that's normal. People, hardcore fans may have reacted, you know, but there was relatively little of it. Once people saw the band, I think they understood that this was a serious venture, you know, and you know, it was, I was quite prepared. I knew that it would be difficult to come back trying to fill up arenas and stuff like that without Lou. But by the same token, I was ready to, you know, dig in and really help to propel the band back to its original prestige, you know, which I think it had lost during the squabbles and the problems that had developed between Lou and I. I was finally playing with a band that I was having a lot of fun with, and it really sparked me again to become enthusiastic about it. There was relatively, after a while, you know, initially there were a few adverse comments about it, but I think we soon proved them wrong, and they've become, you know, hardcore fans since then.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a lot of years. I mean, I mean Kelly's got to be coming up on the amount of time that even probably continuously he's been in the band longer than even Lou was during the first run of Foreigner.
I guess, yeah, pretty much. It's 12 years, I think.
Yeah, and so I guess that leads into kind of this weird situation where, you know, here you are coming up on the 40th anniversary, and, you know, everyone obviously wants you and Lou to get back together, which I think would be great from a nostalgic standpoint, but, I mean, how do you think Kelly would feel that? Because I really feel like Kelly has established himself as your frontman. Without any disrespect to Lou, I don't think he's ever done anything to say, oh, I'm better than Lou Gramm. He's presented himself as Kelly Hansen.
Exactly, yeah. Well, we're thinking about opportunities next year. Nothing is fixed yet, but it's going to be the 40th anniversary of the band, of the formation and release of the first album. So we're planning to try and do something special, maybe with the old members of the band and Lou, do some kind of special event. But as I say, it's not been fixed yet.
I mean, in preparation for that, have you gone back?
I think Kelly would be fine with it, by the way.
Oh, I apologize. I should have let you say that, because I kind of get that sense, too. I've had the honor of interviewing Kelly a couple of times, and he just really strikes me as it's just a really good guy.
Oh, he is, definitely. He's, as I said, you know, he's very respectful of the position he took. And, you know, has nothing but admiration for Lou. And obviously has managed to carve his, like, a niche out of himself and get his identity across, too.
So have you gone back and listened to that first album? Because I don't, you know, I think that there's, I'm sure you talk about how the influence that Buddy Holly had on you. I mean, that first Foreigner album is just top to bottom. It really is it's special. It's a special work. I mean, do you go back and listen to your stuff at all, or is it just something maybe you revisit if you're coming up on an anniversary?
Yeah, sometimes. I might be kind of in the middle of getting a playlist together for myself. And occasionally I hear one or two of the old songs. I sort of refresh myself with what it was like at the time. Yeah, and it still holds the magic for me. You know, obviously what happened after the release was beyond my wildest dreams, but, I'm still very, very proud of that album. It was, we carved out a sound from the word go, you know. I didn't think that we sounded like anybody in particular. We got lumped in with quite a few different people, but I really thought we had our sound and identity that was ours, you know, and not really trying to copy anybody else nobody that really that I felt that we were. Even in the songs, I thought the songs had their own real identity as part of the sound. And of course, you know, Lou's voice. I think I invested a tremendous amount of time working with Lou on the vocals, and invited him to write with me. And we at the beginning we had a very strong bond going that way. Just gradually, I guess, life and touring and studio, living in studios pretty much, gradually wore away the magic a bit. And but I listen to those older songs, and it reminds me of brings me back to where I was at the time, you know, when I was writing them, and wondering where the next Chinese meal would come from.
Well, and, that's interesting.
You know, it was very humble beginnings for us. You know, people were sort of accusing us of being a band that was planned up in a executive suite at Atlantic Records or something. It was not like that at all. You know, it was very innocently put together over the period of a year, and it was very simple question of auditioning a tremendous amount of people, especially vocalists, because I knew kind of after the songs I'd written, I'm not really a singer myself. I mean, I've sung a few things over the years, but I wanted a very strong voice, and I wanted a certain timbre to that voice, and I wanted to have somebody that knew how to phrase a song properly, how to deliver a song properly, how to get the most out of a song. And so over the years that meant a tremendous amount of intimate work with Lou. And I think he learned a tremendous amount in those early years with Fana.
Yeah, and I mean the story is legendary. I mean, I grew up in Rochester, so I know.
Oh, you did.
Have met a lot of the guys in Black Sheep, and I to this day, I kind of scratch my head and go, I can't believe that you kept that album that somebody gave you in Rochester, and even thought to revisit it when you were looking for a vocalist. I mean, that in and of itself is pretty amazing. I mean, did you do that with other bands as well? You kind of went through the old albums and listened for that voice.
It was, very often in those situations we get, we get handed a lot of CDs, or in those days tapes, I'd always found it well, gradually, increasingly, that there was a danger in doing that because, you know, some crazy guys out there kind of wanting to somehow create some kind of a lawsuit that we heard this song and we copied this song, and, you know, that was rampant for a while around that time.
Wow.
But anyway, I mean, I didn't consider Lou's to be that because I knew it, the person who had given it to me, and and I was just sitting around sort of humming Feels Like the First Time in my head, and I took a break and just out of curiosity put this album on, the Black Sheep album, and I listened to it all the way through. The material wasn't very strong, but immediately I heard something in Lou's voice, and a couple of days later he was off the construction site and sitting in the studio in Manhattan, and that's how it all kind of came together.
It's like every kid's dream come true in that story. I mean, it almost sounds like it's something that was written in a movie.
Yeah. It was. I mean, it's encapsulated in the song "I'm a Long Way From Home." Really, that talks about what it was like for everybody to sort of uproot and come to live in or around New York. Deal with the craziness that was New York at the time. It was not a very safe environment in the city in 1976, and so it all figured into that song. Tom, I'm just being told that I have to move on to another.
Okay. Well, listen, quite an honor. Thank you for all the great music over the years, and just for everything. And I wish you continued success, continued health, and we're looking forward to having.
Will you be coming to the show up there?
I unfortunately can't get into Canada because I don't have a passport. So otherwise, I'd love to pop over the border and see.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, if you come back,
you can't do it on the driving license.
No, you have to have, out here, you have to have either an enhanced license or an actual passport to get over. So, unfortunately, I don't have either right now.
Wow, I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So.
Okay, well, I'll tell them to leave the door open. You can hear it open.
It's a great venue. I've been there many years ago, but unfortunately, I said I didn't re-up my passport. So, one of these days we'll get over there. But again, an honor. Please, stay healthy. Have a great trip, and I'm sure our paths will cross again.
Yeah, we're doing a big summer tour next year, which should encompass most of the cities in the States. And we just did a concert at the Carnegie Hall about a week ago.
Wow, that must have been amazing.
Yeah, it was actually, blew me away.
Yeah,
I never ever imagined or saw myself as playing at Carnegie Hall, but we did it as part of this Unplugged portion of the year that we're doing.
And CD came out
that
great.
Has been very. Pardon?
The CD came out great. I mean, that Unplugged CD, the live stuff is just incredible. The way it comes across, it's really strong.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. It's been a nice change of pace. So, and we're playing the Royal Albert Hall in London next year. So,
wow. Yeah.
We're gonna try and make it a special year.
Yeah, doesn't get any better than that. I mean, those are two amazing. And if you pull off the stuff with Lou, that would be that'd be the feather in the cap. So,
Yeah.
All right. Well, excellent. Thank you so much for your generosity. And as I said, hopefully we'll have a chance to shake hands someday. But this has been quite an honor.
Yeah. But, I'm sure we'll be playing. What's the place between Buffalo and Rochester?
Art Park, yeah. I know you've been out to Art Park a couple of times. I cover that for the newspaper.
Okay.
Yeah, or Darien Lake, yeah, that as well.
Yeah, it'd looks like we have we're headlining with Cheap Trick in the middle slot, and Jason Bonham is opening the show.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, and Jason's back with Black Country Communion, so that's cool too. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. So that should be a fun tour. Cheap Trick, we've toured with over the last 40 years, I guess.
Yeah,
we're both 40-year-old bands this year or next year.
Yeah, great stuff though. I mean, both of you. I mean, this stuff doesn't get old, and Cheap Trick is still playing great too.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Okay, man.
All right. Thanks so much, Mick. I'll make sure I send this off to John when it's written up. And
oh, will you?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
will.
That'll be cool.
All right. Thanks so
great.
Much.
Look forward to it.
All right. Bye bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye, Tom.
All right, there you have it, an interview with Mick Jones. Again, as I said, this will be a part one of a three-part Foreigner series. Hopefully there are some Foreigner fans that are out there that will enjoy these interviews. And next episode, we'll do the Kelly Hansen, Tom Gimbel interviews, and save for, you know, the last one, good old Rochester native, Rochester legend, the beloved Rochester guy, Lou Graham. So until then, hopefully we'll see you at a concert. This is Tom Jennings. Please, as always, consider supporting this podcast. If you have any questions, my email address is in the show notes, and we'll see you soon. Thanks.